topology and its application to symmetric symmetry protected topological phases, or SPT phases. So the overview of today is I'm just going to give explain briefly what an SPT phase is and describe what group cohomology is. And if time permits, I'll talk about what I did for my my project in dimensional reduction in SPT phases. So first of all, what is an SPT phase? So basically, what an SPT phase is, it is a quantum phase, which is a zero temperature, and it has short range entanglement. And basically, the symmetry protects the phase. That is, if you want to change from one phase to another, the only way is to spontaneously break that symmetry or close the gap of the Hamiltonian. So I forgot to mention that the bulk of the phase is also gapped. The bulk of Hamiltonian is also gapped, but you could have gapless edge modes if your manifold has a boundary. So let me just give an example of an SPT phase. So for example, if in 1 plus 1D, that's just one dimension with an SO3 symmetry, then there are two distinct phases, turns out. So one is the trivial phase, it's the Heisenberg anti-ferromagnetic that we know and love. And now there is a non-trivial phase, which turns out to be this model. I'm not going to go through why this Hamiltonian produces this model, but pretty much what I'm going to explain is that the difference between these two models is that the trivial phase has is a spin one, while this one, what you do is you have on each side, you have spin 1/2 representations. And this blue line means you form a singlet between these two. Then after that, you have this circle, which means that you project these two pairs into a triplet representation so that it becomes spin one. So what happens is both models both describe a spin one. However, the difference that you can see is that suppose this chain had a boundary, then at one end I would just like cover this up, and you would see that at the end, this one wouldn't be paired with anything, so it would transform as a spin 1/2 representation. So the difference between these two models is that at the bulk they would sort of look the same, but at the edge, this one would have a spin 1/2 representation at the edge. Yes.
What do you mean by phases? Two distinct phases of what?
Two distinct phases. These two are distinct phases.
I thought, like, maybe this is the same question, but like, I thought a phase is something that you associate to like a single Hamiltonian from varying the parameters, but you have like two different Hamiltonians there.
These two are different Hamiltonians, and you can use a unitary transform. Well, if you can transform one to another with a unitary transformation, but that will either break the symmetry, the SO3, or close the gap in the Hamiltonian. Does that make sense? So, anyways, the point I was getting is that at the edges, you would see something different, which is this spin 1/2 instead of this one where you would see only spin one. And pretty much what that's saying is that the edge modes could have projective representations of your group. So I'm going to explain what a projective representation is right now. So pretty much, usually we think of linear representations, which is that if you have some representation of your group G, then the representation is a homomorphism, right? R of G1 times R of G2 is just R of G1 times G2. But with a projective representation, you can have this phase factor, which I'll call omega, which depends on G1 and G2. So when omega is just one, that's that is a linear representation. But if you have omega that is not one, then we call that a projective representation. So for example, in this case, this spin 1/2 is a projective representation of SO3. Why? Because, for example, you spin pi degrees and then spin another pi degrees, then you would get the representation of the identity, but you would get some phase factor, which is minus one. So that's why this is sort of a projective representation. Now, any omega won't satisfy this condition. So we need there's some constraints from this equation. So first of all, what we know is that if we demand associativity, that implies that it shouldn't matter how these which product we do first. So that one gives us a constraint. This is the constraint for omega. And the other constraint is that if I redefine my representation by rescaling it with some mu here that could depend on g, then these two are still the same representation. So if I plug r into that, it means that this omega prime describes the same projective representation as this omega over here. So basically, there's a constraint on omega, and we have an equivalence class of omegas that describe the same projective representation. So these equivalence classes will form some abelian group, and that's because if I multiply these two representation with this omega with another omega, I get another omega, which is also a projective representation. So it forms an abelian group. I will, for now, call it H2 of G of the group, comma U1, because this base factor is a U1. And we'll see later why I named this, and it's related to group cohomology. But for now, it's I'm just explaining this so that motivate why SPT phases should be characterized by group cohomology, and that's because the projective representations are described by this group. So just for example, for G equals SO3, then it turns out that this group, there are only two distinct phases as we've seen earlier. There are only two elements in this group. And the linear representation is that Heisenberg model, and the projective representation is the non-trivial phase, which means that it's the non-identity element in that group, and it corresponds to that AKLT model where you see spin 1 half. Okay, any questions so far? So right now, I'd like to move on to group cohomology, which is what will describe what that group is. And before, I'd just like to take a little detour, because where most of us are familiar with differential forms, so it's useful to, they're very similar, so I'd like to go quickly first. So for example, differential forms explain something called Durham cohomology, and basically, we all know this, I'm just going over it quickly. So an N form is a map, this is not rigorous, that takes N vectors to a value in R, right? So basically, and you can define this exterior derivative to take N forms to N plus one form. Now we call a form closed if D of omega is zero, and the group of all closed forms is noted by this, I'm just calling this, and M here is your manifold. It depends on your manifold which forms are closed, right? And you can also call it exact if omega is D of some mu, so for some N minus one form. And the group of exact forms is noted by D. And you can say that two forms are equivalent if omega one minus omega two is exact. And you form the inequivalent, the group of inequivalent closed forms by modding out these exact forms, and that's what you call the nth cohomology group of your manifold. So, what we're going to do similarly for group cohomology is just repeat this process, but instead we have a symmetry group G, and now I'm going to use multiplication, so it's going to change things a bit. And now I'm going to define an N cochain is just a function that takes in N group elements, so it's G cross G N times, to a value in a G module M. Now, don't worry about this word here. I'm just going to use U1. So just forget this word. This is just for technicality. And similarly, we have an operator D called co-boundary, which takes n co-chains to n plus one co-chain. And then next, we can call omega n a co-cycle if d omega n equals 1. Now, this is 1 because I'm using multiplication. That's not 0. And we just call the group of all co-cycles by the z again, where I have this group element here and my g module, which is u1. Then I define a co-boundary if omega is d of some other co-chain, mu. And the group of all co-boundaries is known by this. And then I do this equivalence class if omega is equivalent to omega n prime if their difference is a co-boundary. So I can form this group again, h of n. And this is called the nth group, the cohomology group of G with this U1. So in case you're confused, this is a summary of what I just did. So we're just changing all this language here, which you're probably used to this other language. So close now means co-cycle. Exact now means co-boundary. I hope it's not confusing. But some people just use these words interchangeably, but I'm going to stick with the canonical one over here. OK, so now I haven't told you what D looks like. Yes?
Correct, like omega n is equivalent to omega n prime if omega 1 minus omega 2, so is that,
mm-hmm.
what's omega 1 and omega 2 there?
Oh, sorry. I meant to say omega and omega prime. Okay. Yes. Sorry about that. Any other questions? OK, so I haven't told you what this z looks like yet. So I'm going to define that right now. And this is a very confusing definition. I'm going to use this picture since it's nicer. Pretty much what it's saying is that I have omega n is an n cocycle, so it takes in g n group elements. So d omega n is an n plus 1 cocycle. It takes in n plus 1 elements. So how it works is that it takes in n plus 1 elements. It forms this product. And now that product works is first I cover this up, and I take in the rest with a plus sign. So that's the first term. And then I cover the next one, I get a minus sign. And what I do is I put in g1, g2, then g3, then all the way to gn plus 1. So I multiply these two together with a minus sign there. And then I keep doing that until the last term, which is I cover this up, and I just take in g1 to gn. And then with a factor of minus 1 to the n over there. So that's what this formula means. And you can check that d squared equals 1, which means that if I do this twice, I get 1. The reason is if I cover this up, you would cover up two things. And there would also always be another term where I do that in the reverse order, and the sign will be flipped. So they'll always cancel. The d squared will be 1. OK, so these are some examples. So just to show you for omega 2, if I cover this up, I get g2, g3 times divided by g1, g2, comma g3. Then I cover this up, I get g1, comma g1, comma g2, g3, right? And then the last term is just g1, g2 with a minus sign. That's clear. Now, going back to what I talked about projective representations, this condition, that long condition from associativity, is just saying that this thing is 1. So my associativity condition implies that the co-boundary of this co-cycle, sorry, this co-chain is 1, which means that omega 2 is a co-chain. Sorry, it's a co-cycle. And this equivalence relation is just saying that I do a gauge transformation, quote unquote, with a co-boundary mu. So this thing is a co-boundary because d of a 1 co-chain is this. So these are equivalent by some gauge transformation, which is this co-boundary d mu 1 here. OK, so that's what it means. And when I do this, when I do this inequivalence, I mod out this. That is why this is what describes the second cohomology group of G with U1 coefficients. So that's why projective representations are classified by this group. Okay. So any questions until now? So to continue the great tradition of condensed matter having graphic representation for stuff like sensor networks and things, I'm going to do that as well. So we can visualize a 1 co-chain as a line. And omega 2 takes in 2 elements as a triangle, which has G1 here and G2 going up there. And the inverse is just the mirror of that. And then for this one, we have a tetrahedron. And this one is the mirror of the tetrahedron. So what we can do next is I haven't filled in the other edges of this tetrahedron. What I basically have this, what I basically need to put is I need a flatness condition, which means that if I go G1 then G2, then I also have to go G1 G2 here to make it flat, so that it doesn't depend on which way I go. So basically, that's what happened. And now this is a 3 cochain, which is a tetrahedron. But now we can also look at d omega 2. D omega 2 is, so omega 2 is a triangle, right? So d omega 2 is a 3 cochain, so that's a tetrahedron. What does that tetrahedron look like? It looks like this. And basically what it's saying that, for example, omega 2 with g2 and g3 is this triangle. And then g1, g2, g3 is that triangle. And these other two are the other two triangles. So what's that saying is that d omega 2 describes the triangles that cover up this tetrahedron. And that's equal to 1 for a cocycle. So that means that if I cover up a closed surface with triangles and it's 1, that's the condition that my omega is a cocycle. Right? So that's, you might compare that. That's very similar to Stokes' theorem. I say that I cover up omega to some boundary of this triangle, this tetrahedron, and that's equal to evaluating d omega on the manifold. But d omega, if d omega is 1, this side is 1, so that I cover this up and I always get 1. Right? So that's the condition of the cocycle. I close any closed manifold with no bound, I mean, any manifold with no boundary and should give me 1. That's the cocycle condition. Now, one more thing I can do is if I rewrite this, I can rewrite this equals 1 in 2 different ways. Those are these 2 equations. And what they mean is, for example, G1, G2 is this triangle. G2, G3 is that one. And that is equal to the other one over here. And that basically tells me that if I have a square, I can break it up into 2 triangles in 2 different ways. And so it doesn't matter if I have if omega is a cocycle, it doesn't matter how I break that up. Or and this as well. So the idea of all this is that suppose I have a manifold and I want to triangulate, suppose I put some spins, right? I can put up or down. But for a group G, I can put G group elements on a lattice with on these points. Right? So basically, I have a manifold, I have some points, and I triangulate my lattice. Then it doesn't matter how I triangulate it. I can break up into more pieces if I want. And if I evaluate omega on this manifold, then it would give me the same answer no matter how I triangulate it. So that motivated this paper to say that, we can, if we wanted to describe SVT phases, then, and we know that SVT phases are related to projective representations, they're classified by the cohomology group, and this cocycles have these nice properties, then let's say, let's just take this manifold, let's fill it with group elements, and let's evaluate it, and we construct this partition function, which depends on these omegas evaluated on this manifold, and we vary over all the group elements possible. So that's basically just like writing a path in a row, right? Instead of writing varying over all the fields and this action, where this action is some integral, right? I just change this to a product. The sum comes down and becomes a product, a discrete integral becomes a product. And then I'm just, this phi is the group element. So I'm summing over all the group elements and then just dividing by some factor. So this product over all omegas. So I turn this partition function. So in this partition function is written this discrete way. And what they showed is that you can construct a ground state, and then you can show that each site, and they could construct a unitary transformation that each site transforms as a linear representation, and then at the edge you could get projective representation. Yes.
So G has to be finite here.
Yeah, yeah. So here where I'm talking about finite, also abelian groups for now. Yes.
Okay. But this should hold for G not abelian.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sure.
Okay.
But also for G not abelian, but
everything you just said should hold for like arbitrary G, right?
With I might have swapped the G1s and G2s, it might be in the wrong order. Yeah.
Okay.
So formally, this has been known. This sort of model has been known in the 1980s. Theory I talked about yesterday in one of the slides. They're called Dijkgraaf-Witten models, and they just recently found their use in condensed matter. Okay. I think there's not enough time, so
about 8 minutes.
Okay. So I might talk. I'll try to rush through. Dimensional reduction, if there are no other questions until now. Okay, so moving on. So what I did last semester was pretty much, you have this model for an SPT phase, and what you can do is instead of having a manifold, what I want to do is I want to compactify, which means that I curl this up into a cylinder, and then I make this radius really small so that it becomes a manifold with one dimension lower. Now, the catch is, what I can also do is, instead of just having this curled up, I can add a flux with group element G inserted. So that would give, what that means is that, I'll explain later what that means, but with this, I can get different models depending on what G I insert. So what does that physically mean? That seems theoretical, right? So what that means is basically, physically what you can do to a system is that you can have this SPT phase. You can gauge it so that there are some excitations such as charges and fluxes. And then you can have this, you can study phases that you gain from winding charges around fluxes or fluxes around fluxes. Now, for example, the thing here is that if I have some loop alpha and beta, then I can wind them around each other. I get some Aronov bone phase. But I can also do that while there's a gamma, another flux, inserted between these two loops. And what that means is that, so if I extend that up, I get this type of flux now. And I can make this radius really large so that it separates into two regions. Now, this, we know that this winding here would give a different answer than without gamma, right? So what this G here is just that gamma winding around alpha and beta. And here, I can view this as a two-dimensional system with point excitations living on this plane, and they wind around each other, right? And that will be different from a system with no gamma, where I would get a different system with a different angle as I wind these two excitations around each other. So they would give me different Aronov bone phase. So how to realize that? So if I have my partition function, say, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, then I want to project it down to 1 + 1 dimension, well, what I have to do is that since I'm going around this circle and gaining a group element G, what I have to do is I put G on the vertical here, and I rewrite my partition function so that it acts like it's a 1 + 1 dimensional system instead. So if I focus in one of these triangles, then what I can do is, so I put G on the vertical, and I have AB over here, and I can write down what my partition function is. So there are 3 tetrahedra here, and I can write down this term, and I will call that my effective 1 + 1 D system. So this whole thing is now a 2 cochain that takes in 2 elements, A and B, with this group element G. So this is me. I'm just saying that I just recall this IG of omega 3, and it's now a 2 cochain. So that describes my 1 + 1 dimensional system. Now, from this definition, you can, has been checked, at least I checked, that they commute. So that if omega is a cocycle, then this one is 1, right? This whole thing is 1. So that IG of omega is also a cocycle. And also you can check that if omega is a coboundary, then IG omega is also a coboundary. So it defines a nice map from this cohomology group HN to HN minus 1, which means that it describes this IG omega. If omega describes an SPT phase in n dimensions, IG omega would describe an SPT phase in n minus 1 dimensions. So then the question is, what if I do this IG omega, but I always get a coboundary? So a coboundary would mean I get a trivial theory, right? Since it's the identity in the cohomology group. If I want to study a higher dimension by putting in a lower dimension, but I always get a boring theory, then how do I discover, how do I study the higher dimension, right? So how do we get information for that? Well, you could say, maybe you could go down one more dimension, but this would still be a coboundary since we know that D and I commute. So the solution we came up with is, you can go down by 2 dimensions at once using this G and H at the same time. So what does that look like? Well, instead, I can't draw higher dimensions, but let's say I want to go from 2 + 1 to 0 + 1. That's sort of weird, but I can put G and H on here, so I have my 3-dimensional system, and make it an effective 1-dimensional system, and I get this IGH. So I'm just going to define that to be this way. Now, it turns out that these two don't commute anymore. You get this extra factor, but the cool thing is that this thing is a coboundary, as we said before. Suppose our theory is boring. We project down one dimension, it always gives you a coboundary. This is a coboundary, then it's D of something. So then I can move the mu to the right-hand side so that this whole product, D of this whole product, is just I, this thing. Then this thing is a co-cycle, so this one is 1. So then I've shown that this thing is an N minus 2 co-cycle. So it does describe an SPT phase in N minus 2 dimension. So what does that mean? That means that, so what I did is that I compactify over a circle, but I use 3 different things. Here I put G in here, I put H in here, and then I also put GH in here. Then I compactify. Then what I get is 3 systems in a lower dimension described by these group elements, G, H, and G, H. But all of these are boring. All these 3s are boring. But at even 1 dimension lower here, where they intersect, I get a non-trivial phase, which is 2 dimensions lower at the junction of 3 phases that are trivial. So what we did was we created a non-trivial theory at this intersection, even though all these theories are trivial, are the boring theory. So that was the cool thing we found. So, ta-da. And to quickly conclude, what we're trying to do right now is extend that. So what I, all of I, what I said is just bosonic. We're trying to extend that to fermionic, and that's much harder because omega is not even a cocycle anymore. It's d omega is not one, it's plus one or minus one. And then you have this extra, another co-chain, which is valued in Z2, and things get complicated. I have to do this Grassmann integral. So I'm trying to do that right now. But OK, so just let me conclude quickly. So SPT phases, they're just these phases with a gap Hamiltonian. They're protected by symmetry. Right? And we can use cohomology group, the group cohomology, to describe these SPT phases. And what I did was I used this slant product to lower the dimension. And we found that lowering by one dimension is boring, you can do this junction and get an interesting two-dimensional lower thing. And you can extract information back about your higher dimensional system. OK. Thank you.
Can I ask a question? Can you say a little bit about how quantum phases are different to regular phases and maybe motivate why someone would be interested in studying quantum phases?
Yes.
Talk was about studying quantum phases, right? Like that. Mm. Yeah. So in general, why would someone be interested in studying?
Well, I mean, I guess you can. There are certain properties that we don't understand about like phases at normal, at finite temperature. I guess so. I'm not sure.
So you can usually study these like SP, like at least in the case of like Dyckerhoff-Witten theory, you can study these like effectively by like looking at like their low energy effective field theory, and then you'll get like some TQFT, and you can work with that. So for the fermionic case, could you do the same thing and just like work with an extended TQFT out of maybe some like cobordisms that have like super directions and the?
I think so. I haven't read about this, but I heard that the corresponding theory is some Crane-Yetter TQFT or something like that. Yeah. But I don't know anything about that. That's just what I heard. Or yeah.
Okay, so let's think that again.
We're Lagrangians. So how do we cancel particle production in general Lagrangians? And how we construct those with recursion? And then I'll talk a little bit about current work and the directions that we are considering right now. In integrable models with one space dimension, there are three very special properties that allow us to reduce very complicated calculations into fairly easy ones. So the first hallmark is factorization of all end-to-end scatterings into two-to-two scatterings. I think that Tomas has talked about this a little bit. Tomas R. Which means that we can have exact S matrices for all end-to-end scatterings with N larger than two by factorizing it into products of two-to-two scatterings. And I will explain exactly how that happens. And this is basically equivalent to definition of integrability in two dimensions. The next one, which is also thought to be equivalent to the definition of integrability in two dimensions, is that we have no particle production, which means that all 2 to n scatterings with n larger than 2 is going to vanish. So in the reason for that is that because we have only one space dimension, there is no angle with the scattering. So with the conservation of momentum and all the higher charges, no matter how high the energy of the scattering is, we're not going to have any new particle produced through this scattering. the number of the particles is going to be conserved. And then we also have conservation of higher charges, which is equivalent to symmetries. We're also looking into the conservation of higher charges, but I'm not going to talk about that today, only about the first two and the relation between them. So let's start with the factorization of n particle scatterings. The formula looks like that. So we have a scattering matrix of n particles with n momenta. And this can be factorized into a product of just 2-2-2 matrices. And the ordering of the momenta from fastest to slowest is very important, because when we are in one dimension, if you think about particle coming from very far away with a high momentum, it could interact with slower particle on the line before we actually have all the scattering happening together. So we need to order the scattering in order for to order the momentum in order for the factorization to make sense.
What if the particles are massless?
Sorry?
What if the particles are massless? That would make sense to
you. Then we still need to order them by energy, I think. I'm not sure about that. But I think that we still need to have some energy ordering, I think. I'd be curious to find out. So how exactly does the factorization work? The only non-trivial step to show is basically from scattering of 2-3, factorizing into 2-2-2, and then the rest generalized to n particles is very easy from there. So let's say I have scattering of 3 particles, which means that the S matrix of the scattering process is a map from the space of states into itself. So I have V cross V cross V for each of the 3 particles. Now, if I want to have just the S matrix of particles 1 and 2, it's going to be just S of V cross V. And the third one is going to be the identity. I've been told to use the stick. And when we have the S matrix of 2-3, this is going to be the identity. And the S matrix is going to map us from V of 2 cross V of 3 into itself. And then the S matrix of 1-3 is S of V1 and V3. And the identity particle is 2. Now, we can see that the S matrix of 1-3 is just the product of all those 3, which is basically equivalent to defining one identity particle, so to speak, and moving it outside so that we actually have 3 2-2-2 matrices. Now, this could seem a bit tricky, because you could ask, well, the S matrices are not commutative, so how do I know if I need to move the identity particle to the left or to the right? And the answer to that is that this is equivalent. So this is the Young-Baxter equation. And here we have, first we have the scattering of 1-2. Time is flowing upwards. So we have 1-2 is first, then 1-3. And then 2-3, and this is going to be exactly the same as starting with 2-3, then 1-3, and then 1-2. And the same goes for having n particles. I just take one identity particles to either side, and then I'm left with a huge blob. And then once again, I take another identity particle to either side and a huge blob, and I end up in the end with just a product of 2-2-2 scattering matrices. and this makes life very easy. The next hallmark of integrability is no particle production. So we know that the unitarity, we require that all the scattering processes are going to be equal to one, all the sum of them, all the possible ones that I'm going to have. Now, zero particle production means that I saturate this unitarity. So this part is going to be equal to zero, which means that the sum of all the 2-2-2 scatterings is just going to be one. And if I want to construct Lagrangians with no particle production, I need to make sure that this part of the equation is always zero. And then I have no particle production. So the reason why we started looking at it was that Pedro, in his bootstrap project, found a set of ACE matrices that had no particle production, but violated the Young-Baxter equation. And that was very strange, because in integrable theories, we expect both of those things to go hand in hand. So every time we have integrable Lagrangians with no particle production, we expect that it's going to obey Young-Baxter equation, but that was not the case. So we were thinking that maybe those sets of ACE matrices do not correspond to physical theories, meaning that we don't know if we would be able to come up with Lagrangians that have no particle production and are going to violate the Young-Baxter equation. So in order to understand that better, we decided to classify all the Lagrangians that have no particle productions in them. So we started with one scalar field. I think I'm only going to have time to talk about one scalar field. Time constraints, but also because we're not really sure yet what's happening with more than one scalar field. So this is still a work in progress. So the potential for the couplings of one scalar field is going to look like this. I have here a constant, and I have phi to the n. We want to talk about general Lagrangians. We don't want to impose any Z2 symmetry or anything. So n could be even or odd. It doesn't matter. So the surprising fact is that we can fix the constant of n plus 1 to cancel all the particle production up to phi to the n. So I'm not going to prove that, but I'm going to show you exactly how it works. So let's say that I have 2-3 scattering. So the sum of all this and the sum of all this, we found, is this clear? Can you see? Maybe I can just use another blackboard. Yes, yes. So this is 2-3. So I have two particles, two incoming and three outgoing. So we showed that this process is going to give me a constant if, like we said, the, for example, C4 is equal 3 times C3. So here, this is going to be 3, And here I just have one. And this is going to equal to minus the 5 point factor. So what I do, I just add this interaction here, and I find the constant through the recursion, and this is going to give me zero. Which means that if I have a Lagrangian with interaction terms up to phi to the n, and I know that all of this scattering process is going to be constant, I just add an interaction phi to the n plus 1 with the right constant in order to cancel all the particle production up to that order. So this is the first step. And then there are a few subtleties in here. So for example, the next one we have in the 2 to 4, this is just going to equal to the six-port function, and the constant is 11. The way I do that is, the way we do that is that we take the on-shell limit of particles 1 and 2, and then we see that when we do this, this diagram reduces to this one. When we do the same here, this diagram reduces to this one, and also this one reduces to this one, and so on. Yeah.
Are you showing here the terms that correspond to half the number changing all
add
up to zero? Is that the point?
I'm just describing. So this is 2 to 3 scatterings. This line. This is 2 to 4.
So, because I thought first you were considering theories that didn't change half the number. So I'm not sure why.
Exactly. So this is what we want to consider. And we want to find out which Lagrangians give me no particle production. So we want to come up with a general formula to generate Lagrangians in which I would have no particle production. How do I do that? I add this constant term to the Lagrangian in order to cancel all the particle production that would happen up to that order.
So
this is how we are doing this.
Okay.
Yeah. Does this work beyond tree level?
Sorry? Mm-hmm. So this is only tree level. It's in one paper, it's been shown that these two, whatever is constant here is going to also be constant up to one loop. But I think it's only been shown with a phi to the fourth interaction, not higher than that. But we're not so concerned about that now, because what we want to do is to find all the Lagrangians with no particle productions at all. So we're going to end up with a larger set that is going to include some particle production with some loop corrections. But this is OK, because it's still we're not going to miss any Lagrangian which has no particle production up to any arbitrary loop correction. So a little bit more on how we find this constant. We consider light cone momenta such that I have nj, the incoming particle, 1 over aj, the outgoing particle. Then we want to set the high energy limit of x going to infinity. And then we have a very cute trick of ordering this momentum. So Let's say that all the momentum of all the particles is going to correspond to the order of x, x squared, and so on, which means that by energy momentum conservation, the two incoming particles that produce all of this momentum inside, so all of these are going to be the outgoing particle, and the first one and the last one are going to be the incoming. This means that particle A1 is going to be proportional to minus 1, and this is going to be proportional to minus x to the power of minus 3 in order to have the energy momentum conservation. Now, when we realize that we need to order the particle and the momentum in such a way, we see the diagrams of this sort are going to be set to 0 with a high energy limit, because if I choose these two, take the on-shell limit of these two particles, then I cannot order the rest of the diagram. So I'm only going to consider the diagrams that can be written in one line, because this is where I can order the particles in such a way. And this is the beautiful recursion relation that we found. So the constant Cn is going to be equal to Cn minus 1 times C3 times Cn minus 2 C4 minus C2 square. And the rest is just going to be 0. This is what we showed. And so with the initial conditions of the C3 and C4, this is going to be equal to 1 or 0. And this was here is going to be equal to either plus or minus 1 or 2. When we do this, we plug this back into the potential formula for the general Lagrangian. We basically recover the Bulow-Dodd model, Sine-Gordon, and Sine-Gordon, which we know that they're integrable and have no particle production. So that's very beautiful. But finding all those constants is something really new. We checked it up to arbitrary order in Mathematica. We like phi to the 8, phi to the 28, and we got exactly all the right constant that we need. So this is really nice. What next? So our initial motivation was to investigate what's happening with the Young-Baxter. So now that we have a class of Lagrangians that have no particle production in them, for one field, they all obey the Young-Baxter equation. But we want to see what happens, for example, when we add like a small term, a little bit of particle production to the Lagrangian, and see how it affects the Young-Baxter. So maybe it will not abate a little bit. Maybe there is some relation between the amount of particle production and the violation of Young-Baxter. We're also looking into multiple fields right now. We've checked two fields. We've imposed some symmetry. We're trying to simplify the terms to reduce it to the same recursion relation that we already found for one field. We believe it's possible. It requires some work. We're going to look into Lax pairs, which are the higher charge conservations. So we want to see, for example, if we choose to truncate the Lagrangian at some arbitrary n, if this is also going to correspond to truncating the higher conserved charges at the same arbitrary n or not. We don't know. There are also more things to consider. We also want to check derivative interactions, which is something that we didn't look into yet, because this derivative interactions really complicate the Lagrangians a lot, because we are not we cannot say that the Lagrangians we find would actually be unique. So it introduces some problem, but we want to look into that. This is it. Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, I want to answer my own question because I just forgot to mention some crucial fact, is that when the 2 to the n particle scattering is going to vanish, for example, when 2 to the 4 scattering, the 3 to 3 doesn't, which is interesting because usually one would expect that we can impose crossing symmetry so that when we have 2 to 4 scattering, we can move one lead backwards and consider it an ingoing particle. But we cannot do this with Lagrangians because the on-shell limit is not going to take place, so that we're going to have some delta function. So we showed that in the endpoint function of 2 to the n, sorry, the n plus 1 point function of 2 to the n scattering is not going to be the same as crossing symmetry. That's something to be aware of.
Thank you.